they'd shut their children from the way that they are talking, and there's no point in responding, 'cause it will not make them stop, and I am tired of explaining and of seeing so much hating in the very same safe haven where I used to just see helping. I've been drunk and skipping dinner, eating skin from off my fingers, and I tried to call my brother, but he no longer exists. I keep forgetting to remember that he would have been much prouder.
It's an intense song to start out with, but it was in my head on the right over here, because we are bigger on the inside. This is Swan Drishti, and you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn, and we're here live from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and I have two wonderful, interesting, very eloquent, what's the word with you, if you can, articulate, are articulate people here in the studio with me, but I don't have my notebook out, so I'm going to wing it. We like short introductions, Twitter character status. So Celeste Simmons is an athletic aficionado, a motivational person being, and also a magician. She is a teacher, she is a friend, and she is visiting me here in New York. We've been in Harlem more than Brooklyn, but visiting me here from Salt Lake City, Utah. Welcome, Celeste.
Thank you.
Don Blair is Don Blair. Don W. Blair. The W stands for, does anyone know?
Wingate.
Mm-hmm. That's the correct answer. He is a professional adventurer, an inventor. He wants decentralized food. I don't know.
Like right now, actually.
Some solid food would be nice. But we can't eat in the studio because we don't want mice to crawl all over the wires. I'm sorry about that.
No problem. No,
I'll feed you afterward.
There is a cat.
There is a cat. We could eat the cat. And I went to the restroom, and the cat does not know how to bury its poop very well. My last cat was toilet trained, and I will never have a litter box in my home again because they're gross, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Don, for being here. Welcome. He is visiting Harlem as well from Boston, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where he's occasionally there. He might be on a boat in a week, so that's exciting. And you also were reading recently on a bus about trigger warnings. So that's interesting.
I'm a little sensitive about the topic. So I'm not ready to talk about it.
Trigger warning. Kind of we're talking about trigger warnings. I like offending people. I think it's funny. So, yes, here we are. Thank you for being here and for talking about books, writing, and all things related to words. We have a list of words that we may or may not use during the show.
Right. Trusticle.
Trusticle is the best one. Yes.
What did we intend by trusticle? What was...
You brought it up.
Because intended meanings are all that matter.
We're intentions. It's all about your intention.
Mm-hmm. What you wanted, not what you actually got, mm-hmm. I think.
You sound frustrated.
Well,
you have no idea.
You're drinking a lukewarm beverage. Anyone drinking a lukewarm carbonated beverage is bound to have some frustration in their life.
I think the secret to happiness is low expectations, though. Mm-hmm. So
this is also true and valuable. Mm. So lower those expectations, people, and you will
right
be
now.
Happier.
For what What's about to happen? Yes.
Yes. So you are reading on the bus right over here. So you like to read?
I do. One of the things that came up on the bus ride with a publisher that I met was this issue of what substrate we're reading from, whether it's electronic or non-electronic.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's something that is kind of boring to talk about, but it's near and dear to my heart. I like paper.
Discuss.
I love paper, but I also am excited about all the things that electronic forms can do. So I'm kind of conflicted. And if I want to say I absorb more, I understand more, I can be more thoughtful about the material if it's on paper.
But it's easier to share with your friends if it's online.
Yep. It's a tactile experience, yep, involving more of your body and brain.
Yeah. And we're tactile creatures.
Right. I'm a fan of both.
Yeah.
Because as I'm reading on my Kindle, I can highlight sections and then years later go back and search them on the Amazon website. That has value for me.
I didn't realize we're doing product placement podcast.
I'm a capitalist.
Okay.
No. There's other reading devices, Nook, ebooks, mm-hmm, e-readers.
Mm-hmm.
I just personally purchased a Kindle. Mm-hmm. And it works well enough.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I really appreciate is I am looped into the Brooklyn Public Library system.
Mm-hmm.
So I can often search for a book, download the ebook, and start reading it within seconds.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks later, it disappears, and I don't ever have any late fees.
Mm-hmm.
So as someone who doesn't like buying books because I'm a capitalist,
I don't think that word means what you think it means.
Because someone who's, moderate income and I don't have money to buy all the books I want to read, that has value for me.
Sure.
Excellent.
So I have arguments for both and I use both in my, mm-hmm, personal life.
Mm-hmm.
It's because I love talking about my personal life.
It seems like the trend is away from paper. It seems like we could find ourselves in a world where it's hard to...
Books are sharks. Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman were talking, and Neil Gaiman was on the same side of view of like, I wonder if one day books will all be digital.
Mm.
And he's like, no, books are sharks. They're prehistoric and they've been around for forever and they'll be around for forever. And other systems might be integrated and introduced, but books are sharks. They'll be here.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah.
Books are sharks. I'm writing that. You can't see this on the radio.
And they have two holes for their jaw.
Well, I wonder if there's more material now also. And so there's
and like open and information. Like,
totally.
You know, did you know when you have those captures? So you remember, like, if you've ever like signed up for something or bought something, sometimes it'll be like, type in the word that you see. Often those are photocopies of books that have been scanned into the system and they'll cross-reference them with 10 other answers. And if they all match, then they upload it to a database.
That's
so
super cool.
You're kind of transcribing books by doing captures, which is crazy technology.
Without agreeing to. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing work for the man. That's capitalism.
Yeah. That's capitalism for you. And Duolingo does the same thing with languages.
Really?
You play Duolingo, you're transcribing web pages for Duolingo.
What?
I know.
That's their business model. That's why they... Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's so clever.
It is.
And sneaky.
I'm a fan of it. I think it's not quite as transparent,
yeah,
as it could be. And I'm not sure why, because it seems like a really incredible thing to be a part of, to help... Like, I'm learning Spanish, but I'm also, like, helping web pages in Spanish be translated to English and vice versa.
The thing that this might be off topic, but what that makes me think of is fighting the man again, and how back in the day you could point to that factory and say, you know, that's where the man lives, and I'm going to go fight that man.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even understand the business models. I don't even understand what's happening. It's that's beyond.
Yeah.
So where's the man? can't fight him anymore.
You can't go to this house and toilet paper his front yard.
If you can't fight him, join him.
Where do I sign up?
I'm going to consider that. Yeah.
Advocate and advocate activist for decentralized infrastructure for food, water, science, and spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, that sounds pretentious. That happens on Twitter, though.
You've got to condense.
You got to condense.
Like, get really selective with your word usage.
I think I'm going to drop spectacle, though. That's kind of...
No, I love spectacle.
You really?
I have magical spectacles.
Spectacles.
I think
it kind of rhymes with trusticles.
So. Well, I think there's...
I'll replace spectacle with trusticle.
I think there's deep value in spectacle because if something happens anywhere, people turn and look. If something's moving, we turn and look. We want to be entertained. We want to see. We want our senses to be stimulated. Spectacle. And I think that if you can, I mean, I've been talking about this a little bit of like how do you instigate massive change? How do we get everyone to recycle within the capacity that they have access to? Mm-hmm. People are walking past three trash cans, trash, paper, plastic, and cans, mm-hmm. and throw a can in the trash. How do we get them to see the bin that could, you know, mm-hmm. like how do you get people to change their behavior? And I think that spectacle, if you grab their attention and make them feel something, they're more inclined to change.
That seems right to me. I have thoughts, but you have thoughts. I can see
we both have thoughts.
Go for your thoughts.
How do we get people to change their behavior? How do we change our behavior is a more useful question, perhaps. And so...
be the change you want to see in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's... I think the more we point outside ourselves, the more disconnected we get from solution. And so I'm thinking of a man named Eugene Genlin, who was a psychologist at the University of Chicago. And he noticed that his patients that made the most progress were able to be connected with their physical body, like you talked about, and be able to kind of track what was going on with them and lead themselves out into a behavior change. So, your thoughts?
I really like where you took that from sort of someone trying to capture someone's attention because you think this is what you should pay attention to rather what like viewing your own self, your own attention and trying to control that.
And the gaps in your own like belief structure versus behavior.
Definitely.
I think we're talking about this a little bit about how everyone wants to be unique, but some people are normal and some people are, you know, iconoclasts, and some people are trying really hard to be iconoclastic, but they're just normal. And some people are trying really hard to be normal, but they're just iconoclastic. But it's this, I mean, you know, watching yourself, how many times am I not doing the little things I can do? Or what more could I do? Make a difference.
I think change that is slow is sometimes also more sustainable. What's immediate is often fleeting.
That's really interesting. There's this phrase, the attention economy, that I don't know anything about. But what I'd heard people characterize what Facebook is trying to do, what Google's trying to do. A lot of the big business now is around directing your attention.
Clickbait. And wormholes. How do you get someone to go down this wormhole?
So on the one hand, we talk about, you know, how can we get people to pay attention to the things that matter? But you've got a lot of people trying to get other people to pay attention to a lot of different things. And then we just become these sites of intervention on the part of all of these other big entities who are...
Well, and I think there's also... It makes me think of effectiveness. So there's been a lot of happening in this world and a lot happening in our country. And last week, I work in Park Slope, and I was taking a break, sitting on the sidewalk, and there's a gentleman walking up and down the sidewalks, and I saw him a couple times that day, and I've seen him before, and he takes a couple of steps, and he says, "Fuck white people," and he takes a couple more steps, "Fuck white people," and I guess he's getting his point across, but, like, where's the effectiveness? What are you doing? And also, at that point, you're not interacting with me, you're interacting with this sweeping idea.
Mm.
So wouldn't it be more effective to, like, connect with a human being?
Mm.
And, I mean, this is my own sense, too, of, like, what am I trying to do and how can I do it more effectively? I'm trying to save the environment. I'm trying to not be a consumer as much as I have been in the past. I'm trying to build my own awareness of, you know, what I react to. Somebody walking down the street, I don't have a strong reaction to because I don't have an emotional attachment to him. But what about, you know, the person that I see every day that I take for granted and whatever, you know, or my family that I don't talk to often enough, or, you know, just finding the balance between the effectiveness of what I'm trying to do and what I'm actually able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And putting my energy, you know, there's a lot of, like, political campaigns that you could join, but I don't know. I don't. I'm just talking. Somebody needs to stop me.
Well, you're talking about
this is my show. Can somebody else talk for a minute, please?
So I think you're talking about finding that sense of efficacy, which is really important. And so the gentleman that you described on the street is, you know, in a sense, probably frustrated, probably cut off from his own power, walking on the street saying "fuck white people." Is more just venting. And so So the questions that you're kind of bringing up are questions around where do we have power?
Well, and let me draw this parallel. I can sit and read a book about providing clean drinking water in Africa. That's great. I have information. Or I could save a bunch of money and join, you know, a service committee that's going out to install a well and educate people about how to maintain it and actually provide people with drinking water. I might not have the means to actually go do that project, you know. So maybe, like, the middle ground is I donate $20 a month to a company organization that's, you know, legitimate and is actually providing people. And, like, that's what I can do. And maybe in 10 years I can go on a trip and help, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference between reading something, believing something, and incorporating it into your life, and making it inconvenient because you believe in it.
And it seems like a lot of people are in the mode where they feel like one of the most effective things they can do is write a sort of impactful sentence on Twitter or a Facebook update.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how does that fit in terms of impact? Or where do you think that goes? Because I'm almost thinking about that guy on the street sort of talking to himself.
He's just tweeting.
He's
real life tweeting. You look at his feed and it just says the same thing every couple minutes.
Well, and just to validate him, I mean, there might be some truth in his expression of his experience.
Fuck mean people. Fuck violent people.
So there's some value there.
Fuck capitalists. I mean, you know, like...
It almost seems in a way we're talking about it now because doing that on the sidewalk in quote-unquote real life is maybe more impactful than putting that on Twitter. Like, if you'd seen that on Twitter, you wouldn't think twice about it. You'd scroll past.
Yeah.
I interrupted you.
No.
No, I interrupted you.
This one did. No, I'm just kidding.
Did I break the trusticle? The trusticle? Oh.
The trusticle is live and well.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
How are your headphones? Quick PS. Can you hear what we're saying? Do you need more volume, less volume?
I think it's good.
Yeah, it's good.
Perfect.
It's good.
We didn't do a mic check, so thank you for... I just want to make sure you're comfortable.
Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly.
Not anything to say. But.
Celeste and I... began this practice last year, 2 years ago, called river writing. And I'm curious if you guys would be open to doing a quick session of river writing. And what it is a reading of a poem and then a timed write, kind of train of thought response to the poem. And pages are ripping, so it seems like I've got a green light. We're okay with this?
Yeah, this is going to make for some great radio, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm just going to trusticle you.
Thank you for your trusticling. So I read a poem, you listen. If there's a line jumping out to you, write it down. Use that as your starting point for free write. If by the end of the poem nothing jumped out, you can write about your coffee this morning. Or
my warm, hard cider this afternoon.
Indeed. I'm going to play some music that may or may not be distracting because people listening may or may not want to hear dead air.
This is a great idea, the way that you're doing this. You've done this before.
Oh, you know. I have a poem to read, and it's called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird by Wallace Stevens. 1. Among 20 snowy mountains, the only moving thing was the eye of the blackbird. 2. I was of three minds, like a tree in which there are three blackbirds. 3. The blackbird whirled in the autumn winds. It was a small part of the pantomime. 4. A man and a woman are one. A man and a woman are blackbird, are one. 5. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos. The blackbird whistling or just after. 6. Icicles filled the long window. With barbaric glass, the shadow of the blackbird crossed it to and fro. The mood traced in the shadow, an indecipherable cause. 7. Oh, thin men of Haddam, why do you imagine golden birds? Do you not see how the blackbird walks around the feet of the women about you? 8. I know noble accents and lucid, inescapable rhythms, but I know, too, that the blackbird is involved in what I know. 9. When the blackbird flew out of sight, it marked the edge of one of many circles. 10. At the sight of blackbirds flying in a green light, even the bods of euphony would cry out sharply. 11. He rode over Connecticut in a glass coach. Once, a fear pierced him. In what he mistook the shadow of his equipage for blackbirds. 12. The river is moving. The blackbird must be flying. 13. It was evening all afternoon. It was snowing, and it was going to snow. The blackbird sat in the cedar limbs. So time to write. If you don't know what to write, you can revisit the line that stood out to you, or write against the prompt, or say what I really want to say is blank.
How long are we writing for?
And we will write for 3 to 4 minutes. So speedy. finishing up the last thought, wrapping up that last line. Right there. That's the sound of air moving under its wings, like the wind beneath its wings. Great. So, part of this is a liberation from having to be good. And with it, we offer this invitation to read what you wrote. And I would like to extend that now. Would either of you care to share?
I'll go.
Thank you, Celeste.
Sure. I am thinking now of children on subway trains, face paint, soft round bellies, tiny hands clasped inside larger hands of their mothers, before concern for planning emerged, a world of imagination and half-eaten Happy Meals, confidence, shyness, self. There really is only one of you. If not you, then who? If not this, why? What is it you must do before you go? What is the gift you bear, hidden in your tissues, your veins, your hands? Treasure that smells of your scent. Courage that shares your name. Speak as though your voice can move mountains. Surely it can.
Thank you, Celeste.
Wow.
Dalton, would you like to read what you wrote?
Homunculus.
That's it.
Thank you.
Really, there was a...
Trusticle?
It was a very short trusticle. trust me, that was the...
Would you read it for us, please?
No, I think I did it wrong.
You can't do this wrong.
It's impossible to do it wrong. I promise.
That's the beauty of it.
And the only thing I will say is thank you.
Oh, great.
I also respect your right to say no.
I was reacting to I am of three minds, that line. Mm. And I was wondering what it meant to say we're of any one mind or another. And so that led me down some very trite thoughts about consciousness, and I ended up writing down the word homunculus and multitasking. Mm. But my God, what you wrote was so poetic comparatively. That's amazing.
I'll share if you guys don't
please
mind.
Go.
But I don't want to cut you off. If we were to meddle you for one more minute and you were to read, I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. No, you should go, and then I'll.
And then you'll go.
I'll
consider.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll our attention to me, and then we'll turn our attention back to you. Which to prefer, the beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos? The same walk down the same street can be an infinite number of experiences. I prefer the walks that bring vibration of love, and yet I must acknowledge the experiences of walks that bring me rage. They leave me tired. They make me sit in unrest and see darkness and difficulty. Is there beauty without contrast, or is it possible for beauty to be an independent experience?
Mm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So it feels like I'm going to say things about what you just said. So beauty, how is it a function of... who is thinking about it, sort of perspective. And I feel like I don't know that that's a valid characterization, but it felt like, Celeste, you were kind of focusing on validation or something. I felt like we're trying to give these kids
I'm
a message that
always focused on validation.
is that what I sort of heard
I heard innocence. I mean, I don't want to. I think it is important to state that in the way I was taught, river writing includes this lack of criticism, which for a lot of people who are perfectionists or critical thinkers has value. But I'm okay talking about this and talking about Celeste's writing, but I also want to say that, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say anymore.
But what
I hear is innocence, of this youthfulness of not having to carry burdens and responsibilities in the same way that you do now, and in hindsight, being grateful for those moments and being grateful for those kids, since they don't know to be grateful for that.
Sure. I'll say a bit about where this came from, and then I'll invite you. Then you guys are invited to respond. Riding the train in from the airport, there was this beautiful little girl. She had on a sparkly heart sunglasses and a rainbow painted on her face, and her mom was with her. She was putting blue lipstick on, and this little girl was so happy. She was eating a Happy Meal. She was just giggling. And saw a couple more kids on the way into Brooklyn this morning, just adorable kids riding on subway trains. And because I am an elementary school teacher, I've worked with kids a lot. And I think sometimes we romanticize childhood as a time before adult stresses were there. But I also see that, and I didn't really touch on this in my writing, but I also see that kids have a lot of anxiety and different issues that that sometimes they outgrow as they get older. And one thing that's really interesting to me that I was kind of touching on is the messages we receive when we're young that stop us from either doing what we really want to do or being who we really are or expressing what we really want to express when we're older. And I often will hear people my age talk about, you know, something someone, a grown-up in their life, said or did when they were young that stifled their creativity or caused them to stop believing in themselves.
I think that makes me think of the artist's way and how she talks about, you know, you have to evaluate the people who, for lack of better articulation, didn't encourage you, who said, oh, you should stop doing this thing, or that's not very good, or whatever it is that they said. I respond to that with the gratitude for positive interactions with children, because I have a lot of negative interactions with children, and I have a lot of conflicted feelings about that. So that's what that makes me think of, you know, the moments when I was like, oh, that kid is cute. I'm like, I rarely think that.
And my thought is just kind of how do we participate in the creation of a world where we're not driven by fear and where multiple perspectives are respected, and where we we're also another thing that's kind of an interesting topic is cultivating the ability to trust ourselves. I think there's a deficit of that in our society, and I think if more of us could have a trust in ourselves, we would figure out the way to go.
Yes, I read an article recently by Mark Manson where he talks about how your intuition is bullshit and how your intuition is justifying preferences that you naturally have, and how it's something to be very aware of when you're like, oh, I feel like this should be the thing, or we should like do this thing. And that being said, I think it's also related to your childhood. I think there's a stage of development where you are either grounded in trusting yourself and your preferences and your desires, or you're not validated. And all of a sudden you spend the next 20 years of your life questioning, double questioning, triple questioning, overthinking, having anxiety, wondering if this is right, if this is normal. And some people are able to process that through therapy, through life, through meditation, self-development, like whatever. But I do think that that is a byproduct of the age we live in, where you're saturated with computers and devices and checks and balances and things, and you perhaps never take the time to sit with yourself and actually feel that hurt or that lack of validation that you felt 20 years ago that's still driving you. I think we meditated a little bit together over the past couple of years. And I think for me, that's something that I became more aware of like, okay, I have this preference. I have this feeling. Now I'm going to sit with it and see if it feels good to trust it and go based on that. So I think that that is what I have to say.
It's some, I really like this. This is something that I've wondered a lot about recently, having been a little bit in a scientific context where people are criticizing one another's concepts and ideas.
And trying to justify it with logic.
And trying to justify it,
but
yes.
There's an emotional attachment to your belief structure. Just look at Copernicus, for example.
For everyone, absolutely. Absolutely. And then running across folks that come from other disciplines, say architecture or painting, where they are used to these sessions, these crit sessions, where you put up your work of art.
And everyone's vulnerable.
Yes. And everyone stands around and they say really kind of savage, personal
challenge
things.
This. Why did you do this?
Yeah.
Justify your logic.
Yeah.
Justify why this is here.
And if you talk to a lot of people who go through that, they'll actually say, okay, it was traumatic and it was difficult, but it got me to a place where I was able to come up with critical perspectives on my own work, and it sort of pushed me forward. And I can imagine people saying that about
ask the right questions.
Writing workshop. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to resolve that tension between on the one hand, not dampening people's spirits, but then this sort of constructive criticism.
Well, I think it honestly loops back into what we were talking about earlier when we were talking about how do you create change with people? How do you, and individually or on a larger scale? I think that we culturally started valuing everyone's a winner. Everyone participated and did the best they could. And so everyone gets the trophy. Everyone gets the ice cream. Okay, we didn't win, but we'll still, you know, like shake hands. Like I'm referring to like co-ed sports as a child is like the specific reference. Obviously, if you didn't catch that, now it's out there. It's explicit. But and I also think that culturally we haven't been...
It was dating. I thought you were talking about dating.
Everybody wins, but in my case, nobody's
nobody
winning.
Wins. Dating is horrifying and traumatizing. But I think that it's related back to that because you can be with someone and be like, I don't want to be with you for this, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this reason. And they will take that and be like, okay, great, but so what do I need to do to get in your pants?
Totally. I had a date recently and the guy said, it was a second date. There'd been some space in between. He said, you know, what was the problem? And so I told him what the problem was. And then he said, are you open to me fixing that? I don't know that change happens that way.
I think, well, and pulling it back is this cultural construct of criticism, and if I'm criticizing you or if I'm challenging you, that's a threat. I'm threatening you, and I'm threatening who you are and what you're about and what you've been taught and the way you're going about your life. And most people have no idea how to cope with that. I don't know how to cope with that. If someone were to approach me even with a sincere heart and be like, Swan, I love you, but you are consistently doing this thing that's a really big disservice to you and to the world around you, my initial reaction is always like, oh, really? Fuck off. Like, I don't care who you are. Like, I'm going to live my, like, you know, I have this, like, rage that, like, rawr.
Like, are there...
And I, as a human being, I'm able to process that and be like, oh, maybe this person cares about me and they want me to be happy and they're just challenging, you know, strongly held beliefs that I have that aren't serving me and that aren't true. And so I have to look at the evidence and I have to process and I have to chew on it. But I think that as a culture, we're taught to trust that first reaction. Mm-hmm. That like, you're wrong and I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. So
I think there's there's a chance for more skill on both sides of that. So if you have a criticism, there's a big difference in giving some general sweeping statement like you're wrong and being more specific and open in your presentation. So, for example, have you considered, you know, X? Have you...
Not being a jerk.
Have you considered it? Or, and I think the more, you know, the so our writing teacher, Nan, shared a quote that hate generalizes, love specifies. So I think criticism that would be more loving would be more specific and would leave room. I've also heard it said that it's not useful to tear down walls until you know what they were holding up. So sometimes our negative behavior patterns...
they're protective.
...are protective, and it takes time to shift those things. It can take a long time. And so that's on the end of presenting criticism. And then on the end of receiving is just that loosening our concepts of... me, myself, and mine, and letting things not always be personal.
It relates to intention and approach, I think. If my intention is for you to be happier or have a better life or quit this job, that's like whatever my intention is has value, but also my approach. And I think the most effective tool that people use on me that I appreciate is reflection. I'm going to just spew out words and thoughts, and then having you vocalize them and hearing them not in my voice, not in my head, not out of my mouth, someone else saying back to me what I just said helps me be like, whoa, I already know what I need to do. I already know how I feel. Thank you for helping me. And I think, you know, you have to let people change at the rate that they're comfortable changing. Slow, maybe more sustainable, but sometimes something huge happens and everything changes overnight. And so both of those are valid experiences, but neither of them can be forced. And I am wise. The wisdom of Swan.
And not without humor.
Not without humor.
Somebody...
any more thoughts?
I was just thinking somebody who does a lot of programming that I know was talking about the rubber ducky technique. Where you have a little rubber ducky on top of your computer monitor, and when you're running into a problem in your code, you tell the rubber ducky what the problem is, and often in describing the problem, you just come up with the solution once you sort of say it out loud.
Mm.
And it sounds like you were kind of using these people as rubber duckies.
Yeah. It kind of goes back to trusting yourself that the answers are not outside of us. I mean, people can offer reflection, but ultimately we will, you know, something.
Introspection.
We'll find our way.
The only way to know yourself is to sit with yourself and talk to yourself and be schizophrenic with yourself. Just kidding.
There's this author, Pink, I think. No, I'm getting the wrong one. But there's a stumbling upon happiness is the name of the book. And his research is around, he's trying to make sort of the opposite point that we can easily fool ourselves and lead ourselves astray. And that if you're trying to figure out where you should head next.
Real bad.
Overall, your best bet is to listen to what people around you
or the think you should advice do. Of like talk to your parents and see how you were as a child.
Yeah.
I like to end my shows with a series of questions called rapid fire.
Oh, boy.
So these are a series of questions. We can talk about them or we can say I don't know and move on to the next question. First question, is there a book you remember your parents reading to you?
Anne of Green Gables.
I was her for Halloween, like 3 years.
Oh, I can see that.
Red hair, you know, that's the thing.
My sister was really into Anne of Green Gables. There was some book that my father had found at the public library around talking to kids about sex that I remember him reading to me. And he was extremely nervous. I've never seen him that nervous.
Sweating buckets.
I remember him sort of rubbing his hands on his knees, kind of like, so I'm going to read you this book. Yeah, that's what I can't remember the title.
Wow.
It wasn't.
What an experience.
It didn't help.
Yeah.
But you remember it to this day.
I do remember, yeah.
Do you remember it? Mm. Is there a book that you have not gotten around to reading?
No.
I am good at follow through. For me, Infinite Jest, but I'm not going to read it. Everyone's like, oh, you have to read it. Infinite Jest, I'm just not going to read it. I'm not going to get around to it. I have limited time in my life. Mm-hmm.
Two that come to mind. There's one by Sam Harris, Meditation Through an Atheist Perspective. Oh. Mm. And then Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic has been recommended multiple times, and I've never...
I will re-recommend that because I approached that book wanting to hate it. I didn't want to like it. Talk about low expectations. I was like, I'm going to shred this book. I'm so critical right now. And I fell in love with it, and I have been recommending it left and right because I think it's one of those things. I mean, it's similar to the book I gave you by Sark, The Creative Companion.
Oh, great book.
That's like the fast and easy version, but effectively it's like, how do you connect to your creative self? And this is what works for me, but also I've done a shit ton of research, but I've created this book that's very enjoyable to read and approach and inspire. Mm. So, Big Magic. I didn't want to like it, and I did. Two thumbs up. Okay, so I read this book called Shocked by Patricia Volk, and she talks about how when you're 12, 13, there's a book you read that changes you. And so my question is there a book that transitioned you into puberty? The book you read when you were like, whoa, I feel things or I think things.
Clan of the Cave Bear.
That was mine.
Was it really?
Yes. How do you feel about the rape scene?
That's where I was like, oh my God, I'm disturbed and I'm too young to be reading this. No, that's the first sexual experience I can recall is reading that book and being like, this is strange, but I feel things.
12, 13, I'm trying to remember.
Judy Blume?
Judy Blume's Economist. Yeah, I have never read Judy Blume, but a lot of people were really influenced by her. Yeah.
I remember seeking out books that would have scenes in them and kind of finding in people's homes.
Dog ear the...
Exactly. The books that were open to those pages.
I worked at a school for teenage boys and I took over the library and I would every once in a while scan the books, make sure things were still in order. Certain books would have pages marked, folded over, and the really big hit was Game of Thrones for obvious reasons. But that's very normal. You know, you go to your go-to pages, you read them, mm-hmm. and reread them, mm-hmm. and tell your friends, and reread them.
This isn't quite the same thing.
Yes!
But there is a book in our library that was about poltergeists. And the whole thesis in the book was that these ghosts appear mostly, like when you look into the stories, the accounts, to adolescents, people who are going through puberty because they've got all this psychic trauma going on and they connect to the astral plane and all of this. And it was a really well-written case study-like book. And I remember hanging out with friends on a sleepover reading the case histories and scaring the hell out of ourselves.
Non-related, do you have a current podcast, Netflix, or streaming addiction?
Is this an intervention?
No. I love addictions. Just choose wisely.
I do have this problem that I can't help but want to know what's happening in the Marvel superhero films that are coming out, but I can't bring myself to go and see them.
notes. So you read Cliff Notes.
There are clips. There are clips on YouTube. And I have pieced together various of these films through clips.
Enough of the story to have an opinion.
It's terrible. It's terrible because I don't get the whole thing. And then I did that with a couple of other HBO series recently.
Game of Thrones, I watched. I got sucked in through the graphic novel. And then the graphic novel stopped, but the HBO series continued, and so I started watching. But the first three seasons, I watched it time and a half because I was in a hurry and I just wanted to know what was going to happen. And those are long; it's like an hour per show.
Wait, you can watch those time and a half?
If you have a PlayStation, you can change the speed of playback.
And what's it like?
It's faster. Another thing. Another thing I watched fast was Project Runway. And if you're familiar with Heidi Klum, listening to her talk fast, she's like, "Welcome to my contestants, here we are." She's a mouse. And that's terrible, but I got the biggest kick out of it. I just wanted to see what the designers came up with. Like, what's the challenge? Okay, what did you make? And all the drama, I just wanted to like, okay.
That's I think you've just changed my life.
That's a whole, I could imagine a bar in Brooklyn that only shows like on projection 1.5 times speed.
Yeah.
Project Runway. Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah. Okay, Celeste, do you have any addictions?
Where to begin?
Just warmed us up with the other questions. So. This whole thing was a grand intervention to now.
I don't want to admit this on the air. I listened to the PTI podcast, Pardon the Interruption. It's a sports show.
Yes.
And I listened to a show called Finding Our Hunger.
And Dharma Talks.
Yeah, and I mostly listen to Gil Fronstahl at audiodharma.org. Addictively.
Compulsively.
Yeah.
Can't control it. It's taking over my life.
Right.
I can't pay my bills because I have to listen. And
then... to this free internet.
Yes. Okay, so as a writer, is there writing advice that has changed your writing? Most impactful, memorable piece of writing advice?
Quit while you're ahead.
I was going to say something along the lines of just do it.
Yeah, just write.
I tried open mic stand-up the other night, and I was super hesitant. And my best friend Lisa before said something along the lines of just fucking get up there. It's not bad advice for life, you know?
If you don't do it, you're never going to do it. Yeah.
But if you do it, then you did it, so.
Then you did it. Or you're doing it.
Don't do it.
Yeah. You're the anti-Nike. Okay, is there a book that you most often gift or recommend?
The Bible.
We all know that's not true.
I know that's not true. Sorry.
Ooh, I'm a great gift book. It's a great question.
Yeah, because part of it is like, who are you giving it to? That's going to impact.
There is a great book. It's called Blue Jelly by Debbie Bull. It's a quick read. She was a writer for Rolling Stone, and each chapter ends with a canning recipe, hilariously written with like an anecdote about the time she interviewed Bob Marley or something like that. It's a great read, and it's got some humor, got some sorrow.
I like to laugh. I like to cry.
I like to can.
I like to preserve. I like good food.
I think Don's most gifted book is the Anarchist Cookbook.
Ooh. No?
canning recipes.
Speaking of recipes, have you tried? We're talking about paleo diets, and you're like, the original paleo diet was people, cannibalism, which has become ritualized and now stigmatized.
I know. Stigmatized.
Have you tried it? Don't knock it till you try it. Oh, my God.
First, knock it really hard.
Knock it real hard.
Can we have Dawn do a quick intro or synopsis to David Graeber's work?
Please.
Oh, goodness.
William,
please.
He's an anthropologist who did a lot of stuff with the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. Now he's in London. Really cool stuff, sort of analysis of the various modes of relationship that people can have with one another that really makes you think about alternatives to the current system. That
there are other ways.
There are other ways. Yeah. And I hadn't before reading him, I hadn't come across anthropology as a great way into those questions to see like what people have done in the past.
Sure. You know. One last question. Mm-hmm. If I were to walk into your house right now, what is the first book I would see?
Hmm.
Out on the coffee table, on the shelf, eye level.
The coffee table book photographed by Zoe Rodriguez called What I Thought I Saw.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Absolutely wonderful. Dawn.
I think I left my room in a hurry, so I think there might just be, you just might see tax forms.
Ooh, taxes. I have a book of short stories compiled by Neil Gaiman and Joe somebody. It's called Stories, and it's his most recent release. And there's some disturbing stories in there, but there's some beautiful stories in there as well. So thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for having us. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. This has been Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. And I will leave you with the word take it or leave it, Cadre.